live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network, TotalTutor.net, for more information. And I had this guest on probably about 4 or 5 months ago and just was blown away with the work that she does, how she helps others, and things like this. And this movie that she's involved in is tremendous. So I want to welcome the program celebrity, Diane Nam. Diane, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
Oh, I'm excited to talk to you as well, and especially when we're talking about this film, because, I mean, when I think about this in so many different ways, to know that adolescents are forced into marriage in the United States, it's shocking to me. It really is.
It was shocking to me, too. Which is actually why I did the first film called The Sacrifice and then the follow-up to it, which is called Finding Hope, both starring Molly Quinn, The Sacrifice when she was 13, and we filmed Finding Hope when she was 16. And we, of course, have a stellar cast in addition to Molly, some of them returning from The Sacrifice, Chris Mulkey as the polygamous cult leader, who actually was the one who came that day in The Sacrifice to take the 13-year-old as his bride, and then he reprises the role in Finding Hope. And in Finding Hope, what we see is 3 years later, after this young girl has been forced into marriage, what her life is like. And in the interim between The Sacrifice and Finding Hope, I had done a lot of writing mentor workshops at-risk facilities, like Phoenix House and Penny Lane Group Home and stuff like that. And I'd heard a lot of stories while I was there, and I felt that the continuation of The Sacrifice had to be what would happen if a 16-year-old girl wasn't safe at home and had to run away and ended up in a big city, what would happen to her there? And then that's when the issue of human trafficking became involved in this story. Because young girls, runaways, young boys as well, when they become runaways, they become, you know, basically prey for those who are interested in using them for commercial sexual exploitation. And so my advocacy extended now to not only runaways and homeless kids, but to those who'd been inducted into the trafficking circuit.
I mean, Diane, when you talk about laws in our states, we need to contact our politicians about this and allow with parents' permission young children to be married. That's just back in the day when, you know, you needed farm hands, but at this time in this place, this is uncalled for.
Well, I mean, to be honest, what initiated my beginning in filmmaking, honestly, was that I heard about a state Supreme Court ruling in Colorado that upheld the marriage of a 15-year-old to a much older man. She challenged the statute in order to change the law as opposed to just getting a divorce, and the state Supreme Court at that time upheld the law, saying that because she had been married with parental consent and or a judge's order, the marriage was legal. That was later overturned in the legislature, but before that happened, I wrote and directed The Sacrifice because I felt I had to in order to let that be known. And so those particular societies exist even now. There are over 30 states in the United States that still have child marriage laws on the books that permit a child to be married. A lot of these marriages are sometimes called spirit marriages, so they don't even care if they're legal. And basically what they do is, you know, they breed children in order to be able to then use them for both a labor force as well as you know, basically sexual domestic slaves. I know there's a lot of different portrayals of how those communities work, but I did do a lot of research, and you know, it's kind of borderline trafficking as well, since the girls who are bred in one compound are oftentimes shipped, you know, across state lines and even across country lines from Canada or Mexico in order to satisfy whatever marital needs some of these very powerful cult leaders have.
Do you think your films are going to help really bring that awareness so that people start looking out for these things? And I think the only way to do it is to change the laws, but through your activism, hopefully that will lead to these law changes.
Well, I think, interestingly enough, when The Sacrifice first came out, it came out 20 days, I think, before the that raid on that Texas compound happened. And then, of course, there was the Warren Jeffs trial. And so, you know, the fact that I'd been researching it and then made the film, and then all of that started happening, just seemed very timely. I don't know that my film per se influenced anything, although I had sent it out to a number of people who were in the news field, so that maybe there was attention paid as a result. I don't know. But I do know that there was a tremendous amount of attention paid then. And that was kind of what I was trying to do with Finding Hope, was to turn that same attention to the human trafficking problem. And in the intervening years, it seems as though human trafficking has also kind of exploded as a consciousness, not just as a third world problem, but as a United States problem as well. And so, you know, my only hope is that when I write a story that I care deeply about, is that enough people hear about it, and then it spreads a seed. And that's why I tell the stories that I do. As I say, you know, when asked what kind of stories do I want to tell, you know, I want to tell stories that matter, that plant a seed in people's thinking, so that then they become aware of things, and then they become activists in their own way. You know, whether it's noticing the girl on the street and no longer thinking of that what she wants to do is streetwalk, but recognizing that she has a past and that she's not there of her own volition, and maybe look at her differently, try to help her. If there are situations where you see abuse or you see some kind of strange situation where a child is in danger, then, you know, call it. And Finding Hope is something that we're hoping to create into a television series, whereby we would then, at the end of each episode, provide a hotline number so that if people see the situation that's depicted in the episode, they know where to call.
Well, Diane, I hope that I can be a great spokesperson for you to make sure that when this does happen, I hope that you do get the TV series, because I think what's so important is that we need to stop this. And the only way to stop it is people to be aware, as we talked about before. What has been the response so far for Finding Hope? What type of response have you been getting?
Well, you know, it's screened in a bunch of different festivals. I have a couple of distributors who've already asked me if they could broadcast the film. I'm just waiting for it to finish its festival life before I do that. When you're in an audience where people see the film, you know, they're kind of, it's an interesting phenomenon watching people become so absorbed in what's happening that you can tell that they're just absolutely on the edge of their seat wondering what is going to happen to this girl, which is a tribute, I have to say, to the acting from the entire cast, you know, from Chris Mulkey, Molly Quinn, Richard Reel, James Morrison, Kristen Dalton, Raya Bruzzo, Andy McKenzie, all of the people, Christina Lee, Karen Landry, everybody who's in this film, I was so lucky to have them, because the performances they gave were absolutely, you know, breathtaking. They're just so compelling, but it's very hard to turn away. And for that, I'm very grateful. And I think that audiences, when they see it, they just want to know, well, what happens next?
Right.
Because I've kind of left it as a sort of a cliffhanger in the hope that you know, selling it as an episodic, that it would appeal to people in that way as well. But it is very definitely a short film right now. But, you know, I did a special screening for the kids at Covenant House, which is an organization that houses homeless teens and gives them training and then tries to sort of reinstate them back into society. It gives them another option other than, you know, the predators on the street. And when I screened it for those kids there, Molly was with me. And honest to God, I could hear a pin drop. There was No one moved until the very end. And these are kids who have a lot of trouble staying still sometimes. No one moved. And they were, you know, very moved and touched by what they saw. But not only that, they actually sort of genuinely for a moment suspended disbelief and thought that Molly had actually gone through that. And they came over and hugged her as in comfort because they realized that she was a kindred spirit in the sense that they had seen her character on the screen, which was, I think, kind of an emotional moment for both Molly and me. So I think that there's a lot of authenticity in the film that everybody responds to. I know that while filming, a number of the crew came over and asked me if this had been my experience because they felt that, you know, there was just so much going on that they were curious. And I have to, you know, say that that's because I spent as much time as I did sort of researching, and I think that the actors did as much as they possibly could to bring those, you know, those feelings to the screen.
So for the cast involved in this, they must have felt very, very proud, but also very happy that they're able to go ahead and bring this awareness, to be involved in a project that's really trying to help people. A lot of times you have projects in Hollywood, especially films, that you're really not bringing any type of message. And I think that that probably made your actors and actresses come to work each day really motivated to work because they knew what they were doing.
I think that that's true. I mean, you know, what's not talked about a lot is that almost everyone who works in the acting field in Hollywood is always on the lookout for a good-hearted project. I think it's what makes them, you know, truly love what they do. I'm not saying that they don't love the other things, too, because those are fun and they're great to do and, you know, they're very economically advantageous. Mine was not. You know, everybody from crew to cast, everyone involved, you know, worked at a very low budget, at the low budget rate, and they worked their hearts out. And I think it's because they too felt that this was a very good-hearted project and they wanted to be part of it. And again, for that, I'm very grateful.
And I'm sure that that made it easy for you to manage and to make sure in the way that the film comes out the way that they want, because they were very easy to direct in a lot of ways and lead, because sometimes different projects, egos get in the way. But when you're thinking about just the story itself, you can't have an ego at all because you're just thinking.
I would say that we had one of those, like lightning in a bottle kind of things where ego was never an issue for anybody. I mean, I had a great producer. I had a truly talented director of photography, Mark Peterson. My producer, Eric Mofford. My editor, Lindsay Mofford. I mean, these are people who brought their, you know, A game.
That's right.
To a set that they were not being paid A game for. and they did it with their hearts. And I think that the film reflects that as well. And you know, we had a set where ego was never an issue. It was always about what's the best thing we can do to tell this story today.
Well, fantastic, Diane. Where can our listeners find out more about the film and about yourself?
If you go to ladyofthecanyon.com, that's my media production company, and so there's information about me, the projects, also Finding Hope. Finding Hope has its own website, which is findinghope.tv. So either ladyofthecanyon.com or findinghope.tv, and both places will eventually lead everybody to where they can see the full film, either online or by broadcast.
Well, Diane, thanks again for calling the program. I'm glad to have you back on and want to have you back on a monthly basis. So I'll talk to your publicist so we can talk about upcoming projects, ways we can promote. And if you want to bring any of the actors on to talk about the film and how they felt about the whole process, we can do that as well. So we'll try to set all that up. So thanks again for calling.
That's great. Thank you. I hope you feel better. And I thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you, Diane. Take care.
Take care, bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Total Education Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Celebrity Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity segment, and I'm really excited to welcome Grammy Award winner, two-time Grammy Award winner, Howard Levy, harmonica player. Howard, thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
All right, so Howard, tell us specifically how you started to become a harmonica player. Who got you exposed to this music?
I grew up in New York City, and the drummer in the band that I was in high school got turned on to Chicago blues and was listening to Paul Butterfield and James Cotton and, Little Walter and Big Walter and all these great blues harp players. And I had never heard anything like it before, and I fell in love with the sound of the instrument.
Absolutely, and because of especially where you grew up, the blues is something you really enjoyed, so this is particularly a great instrument to play when it's the blues, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the harmonica, it's amazing because it was invented in Germany to play Bavarian folk music, but they accidentally invented the world's greatest blues instrument. It's one of those incredible happy accidents of music.
All right. Well, cool. Let's go specifically, Howard, to, I guess, once you got involved in playing the harmonica, what age were you when you first played it?
I was 18. I went to Manny's Music on 48th Street in New York City and bought my first harmonica for $2.25 and went over to my friend's house and said, hey, teach me how to bend a note. And he said, I can't. It's just a feeling, like riding a bicycle. I'm like, oh, you're kidding. Because nobody was really teaching back then. And so I just messed around with it and until one day, like a kind of like a religious experience, like a revelation, I figured, I don't even know how it happened. All of a sudden, I was bending notes, like riding a bike, exactly like that. You know, you fall and you skin your knees for, you know, a few weeks, and then all of a sudden, you're up there pedaling away, and you're going, wow, how did that happen?
very interesting, Howard, when you're telling the story is, did you have a musical background before that? Did you play other musical instruments?
I started playing piano and improvising and composing when I was 9 years old. So I studied classical piano and theory on Saturdays at the Manhattan School of Music, and I was just kind of a born improviser. And I played a whole bunch of different kinds of music and got into blues and jazz and was already starting to write some really good jazz compositions when I was 18. And I picked up the harmonica, as I said, just because I fell in love with the sound and I loved the blues. And so then once I started playing it and getting the blues licks down, and then I realized that there were notes missing. So this was crazy to me, being a piano player. How could an instrument not have all the notes on it?
Exactly.
Every instrument has them, right? I mean, what's wrong with this thing? And plus the fact it's invisible, you can't see anything you're doing on the harmonica. You put it in your mouth, it disappears. There's no keys to push down like a saxophone. You can't buy a fingering chart. You know, it's just all, you know, by feel. The instrument doesn't tell you much. So that's when I tried to figure out how to get those, quote, missing notes.
Quite interesting. It's a very interesting story. So your musical background said, you know what, you had that gift. You absolutely had that gift when you were 18, when you picked up that harmonica, because did you ever think, did you have dreams of the other instruments you were playing growing up, that was going to be your big break? And somehow,
well, as a kid, you know, you're playing a band and you say, hey, let me try the guitar. You do the guitarist's guitar. You fool around with the guitar. You learn a few chords. Oh, how does the bass work? You know, oh, I see. Here's the four strings. And sit down with the drums and you say, show me how to play a rock beat, whatever. And, you get a little bit of a feeling for how to play other instruments. But I never, like, really seriously wanted to play any other instruments until I heard the harmonica, and that was like a different thing. And then once, as I said, once I figured out how to bend my first note, which happened in the first week of college in the Chicago area where I still live to this day, that was like a transforming experience for me. It was something very powerful, and I got obsessed by playing this instrument.
Okay, so you start playing the instrument, Howard, and then what happens next? Specifically, did you start trying to play gigs and just for fun, and then it came, and then the opportunities opened up?
Well, I what started happening was I as I said, I was trying to find the missing notes on the instrument. And I did. I figured out these techniques that, unbeknownst to me, nobody had ever figured out before. There was one recording where one guy hit one of those notes in 1931. And that's really the only thing that I've ever heard where people play those things. I know that other people must have stumbled on these things, but I decided that I was going to make them a part of my technique. There are seven missing notes on the instrument that I figured out how to get, these techniques that I called overblowing and overdrawing. And I just tried to integrate it into my playing and play other things than, you know, beside basic blues, and started playing jazz and, you know, Middle Eastern music and Indian music. And, you know, I'm continuing to play piano, but I started, you know, started sitting in with people. And in the mid-1970s, I started playing gigs in Chicago, and then people started finding out about me, and then I got some gigs with some prominent singer-songwriters, Steve Goodman and John Prine, and started touring with them and recording with them in the late 70s. And then in the early 1980s, I started playing on a lot of commercials in Chicago, because it's very rare to find a harmonica player who can read music. And so I ended up playing on a few hundred of these commercials each year in the studios, which gave me this amount of experience under fire. You know, you get into the studio, they shove a piece of music in front of you you've never seen. You look at it, you figure out how to play it, and the click track comes on, and you try to get it right the first time. And if you don't get it right the first time, you try to get it right the second time or the third time, but you don't get a million tries, you know. So it really developed my musicianship and my playing of the. Of course, I was playing live in lots of clubs and playing on people's records. I guess the next big break came for me when I started touring with Pachito de Rivera, the great Cuban jazz saxophone player and clarinet player. And I recorded two tunes on this album of his called Explosion in 1986. And that brought me to international attention, because no one had ever heard anyone play the diatonic harmonica in jazz before, you know. So, and then I also put out my first record, which at the time was on cassette. It was called Harmonica Jazz, and I played Charlie Parker and John Coltrane tunes and some of my original things with the jazz trio, piano, bass, and drums. And so I'd say those two recordings started getting me lots of attention.
Well, it sounds like, again, like any artist, you go through pay your dues. You started to tour, you started to do commercials, then you got your big break. And would you consider yourself one of the best harmonica players in the world?
Think about it. I don't look in the mirror and say, you know, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? You know, I don't think of myself that way, because I'm too busy working hard. But yeah, obviously I am, because, you know, that's just the truth. And, you know, of course, I went on to play with many, many more people and teach a lot. And I put out a whole bunch of instructional material as well, which people were bugging me to do this. They said, Howard, you have to get this stuff out. And I was a little afraid, because I was afraid that, you know, if people started playing the stuff I played and sounded bad, which did happen. And people would say, who the heck taught you how to play like that? That's awful. And they'd say, Howard Levy. And they'd go, oh, he must really be terrible. So that did happen a little bit. There's definitely been some backlash. But now, over the years, the techniques that I pioneered have become part of the harmonica mainstream, to the point where there's a lot of people, younger people, learning how to play these things who don't even necessarily know who I am, which is sort of funny, because in the beginning, I was the only one doing it. And so it's kind of a good thing in a way that it's become accepted as normal to be able to get all these other notes. And I don't care if everyone knows that I'm the one who figured out how to do it or not.
Did the Blues Brothers movie influence you at all, Howard, or was it the same time you were playing the harmonica?
Blues Brothers movie?
Yeah.
No, I mean, I thought it was very funny. I mean, obviously, and I actually was playing a gig in the club in Chicago where those guys were hanging out while they were making the movie. It was a bar. It was a club called the Earl of Old Town, a very famous club. The owner just died a few days ago. And I used to play in there with Steve Goodman and Bonnie Kolak and a little place in the back called the Sneak Joint that Aykroyd and Belushi used as their hangout. And they were always in there. So, we'd go back there, and it used to be the dressing room. And those guys would be hanging out for a while time. So, that was a very pivotal movie in making the general public aware of blues.
Yeah, and also the love of harmonica as well, wouldn't you agree, from that movie?
Yeah, because the harmonica, it's really an instrument that people think of as a toy, and they don't know what it can do. And so if you see someone playing it, even if they're not great, if they're playing something compelling on it, it definitely turned people onto the harmonica. Even Bob Dylan, he popularized the instrument even though he basically just blows and draws through it and uses it as a prop. But it has feeling. That's the thing, the crazy thing about the instrument is that you don't really have to be very good to get up on stage and play it. I'd say probably you can get away with more knowing less on that instrument than any other instrument in the world. If you played saxophone really badly and you got up on stage, people would throw tomatoes at you. If you just breathe in and out through a harmonica on stage, people go, oh, that's cool. Because the harmonica, the funny thing about it is it's the only wind instrument that can play chords. And it can also play rhythms, and it can play melodies. And sometimes if you have a good enough, if you figure this stuff out, you can play chords, rhythms, and melodies all at the same time. So it's very versatile, and it seems to fit naturally into folk music as well as blues. And then I've pushed it into, all these other things, obviously.
Well, very interesting, Howard. So basically what we're learning about is specifically your career. What the big honor of getting that Grammy, how did that kind of, it must have been just so unbelievable, wasn't it? Once you finally got
it was a great feeling. That was from playing with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. And the first one, we were nominated several times, and the lady finally won one in the mid-90s. After I had actually been out of the band, but I sat in a few times and played on this recording that won for Best Pop Instrumental. And I was a very big part of the recording. I played the melody, the tune, and it's called The Sinister Minister. And it was a shock to them. The other people nominated in the category were far more well-known than we were. I remember Stevie Wonder and Smashing Pumpkins. And So we're sitting there in Madison Square Garden in New York, and we're all sitting together and had no expectations of winning. It was just great to be there. And then they announced that we won, and we got up there on the stage and and Bela kind of went, humana, 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 what do you say? It was very exciting. And then the second one that I won was just 2011 for co-writing a tune. It was Best Instrumental Composition, which is really thrilling for me. And I wrote it on the harmonica, which I really write most of my stuff on piano, but this piece, I really wrote most of it, the main melody, on the harmonica, and much of the rest of it, even though I did also play piano on the track. So it was called Life in 11, and I actually didn't go to the ceremony for this. I had some conflicts in my schedule. But just hearing about it and seeing those two Grammys in my living room, It's a really great feeling. It's partially luck, who you're affiliated with, right. But also, it's a genuine honor. And it felt really great to me to be nominated for something I wrote, because I've been writing music since I'm 9 years old, so it feels great to have that acknowledgement and to have the harmonica be the voice that expressed it.
Exactly, Howard. Again, I guess you're the king of harmonicas. We can title you in many different ways. But, Howard, where can my listeners find out more information on you and learn more about you?
Well, the two big things of me online, the three or four big things, but the really big thing that I'm very excited about is my harmonica school. I have hundreds of members from all over the world. It's called... You can get to it several ways, but artistworks.com/Howard-Levy or howardharmonica.com. I teach absolutely everything I know there. And at every level, from the most beginning, like how to play O Susanna, the how to bend notes and play blues and how to play the most advanced jazz and Middle Eastern music and classical music.
How cool. Yeah.
It's the company, Artistworks, is a fantastic company. They've really picked some of the best musicians in the world and got them to be teachers. I feel really, really happy and proud to be part of their music campus. And it's one of the things in my life that I get the most satisfaction from. And then I also, of course, have my website, which is Levyland, one word, .com. And my touring schedule is on there. I'm going to be in Europe in mid-May, playing my harmonica concerto twice and playing a new piece that someone composed for me, full of all sorts of Bulgarian musical influences with an orchestra. This is really exciting. I have my own record label, Balkan Samba Records, which you can also look up. I have 7 or 8 CDs out on it and a DVD. I have so many different things that I do.
Absolutely. It seems like it, Howard. And we have run out of time. So thanks again for calling the program. And we'll definitely have you back a couple months to give us updates of how your tour in Europe went. So thanks for calling.
Okay, Neil. It's been a pleasure, man.
All right, take care, Howard. Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to Toll Education Celebrity Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment. We'll be back in just... We're back to the Toll Education Celebrity Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle Celebrity Segment. Remember to go to simplyg.com, wearethechallenge.com, totaltutor.net, and last but not least, beachlifestyle.com. And I want to welcome the program, Grammy nominee, singer Ann Walsh. Ann, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So tell us specifically how you became a singer and when you knew that this was going to be your career choice.
Well, I was actually a dancer first, and I danced, studied ballet for about 7 years. And I always had it. My grandmother was always pushing us to sing, and I always knew that I could sing. When I was 7 years old, I went to see a production of Oliver, and I realized at that time that I had a voice because my voice was just like this boy soprano. And so I never really got into singing until my cousins had formed a family group. And so when I was about 13, they would let me sing with them, and they were wonderful. And then I decided to leave dance, and I took up music. I decided to sit down at the piano, and I had a lot of music around me, so I would watch pianists play, and I would play around with it and find chord progressions, even though I didn't know what I was doing, and I would write songs, and so that's kind of how I began and realized, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to sing, and so I didn't even study music until I went to college. I had to audition. I took a private piano lessons my first semester, then the second semester of my freshman year I did voice and piano, and I had to audition, and so that was the beginning. I remember feeling so inferior to all my classmates because they all had studied an instrument before they got in, and but hey, I got voted most musical when I graduated, so that was cool.
well, Anne, I find this very fascinating to know that, you know, you didn't really take voice lessons when you were younger. You really didn't do a lot of the different things. And to be as successful as you are as a singer, it's very surprising that, you know, you were a dancer and then just lucked into certain things and then found out you had talent. Who was the first person that said, you know what, you have some talent, Anne, that you really have to look at maybe a different thought process than just dancing?
Probably my aunt, Patricia D., my late aunt. She just passed away this past summer,
okay.
Which was very sad. But she was the one who had all these wonderful children and the family group. And so it was probably Pat D. Yep, she was just an incredible, extraordinary person.
Quite interesting. So once you knew that you had it and then you felt inferior, as you said, when you were going to school for this, and everyone has studied this their entire lives, like they practiced since they were probably 3, right? And you're like, what am I doing with this group?
Right. I remember we had to take methods courses in different instruments. And my first instrument was the clarinet, and the teacher could see me shaking whenever I had to play a solo. So he just labeled me, okay, we're going to, the nervous one over there. it was funny. You got to have a sense of humor.
So when you were in school, did you finally figure out maybe this is something I'm pretty good at? Did you, especially when you're looking at these other people?
I did. And I was, I had some very generous peers too, who encouraged me. Some singers that were older and musicians, and I still have them as friends. It's amazing. You know, we go back east. We just did a incredible concert at Mechanics Hall in Worcester, Massachusetts. It's part of the WICN Jazz series. And we decided to do it this March, and because we just heard of it last summer, because we do East Coast tours and New England tours every summer. And I just lost where I was going. You asked
no,
me.
No, that's fine. No, that's okay. I can get you back where you're going. You basically said you were friends with a lot of people from when you were, and then you figured out you were very, very talented at what you did. But the people that were around you, that you surrounded yourself with the right people, then Anne, right? That's what it sounds
right,
like.
Right, exactly. And the thing is, with Mechanics Hall, it's like we go back, and I have friends from all different stages of my life that show up at these performances, as well as new fans. And it's really great, you know. So it's wonderful to be able to go home and to be able to perform and just have a network of people who you know encouraged you.
Exactly. They encouraged you to go on further. So once your schooling was over and you started to make this your career, was it like, what would you say was your big break? Tell us that story of finally you said, here's the break that got me a lot more work and really led me to where I am today.
Wow. That's a tough one. My biggest break. Well, it just depends on where I was in my life. I remember being hired with the Long Beach Municipal Big Band, and that kind of put me on the map. Honestly, having a Grammy-nominated CD opened a lot of doors for me. People took me more seriously. It was easier to get gigs and be included in concert series. And that's like our big goal. Sure, we do. I have some steady gigs here in California, but, you know, my main push is for concerts, to be doing concerts. And so probably I would have to say having a Grammy-nominated CD. And you know what? As far as having a master's degree in music, that's a big deal, too, and that can open some doors, but that's a little different.
Yeah, let's go to specifically the story of when you were nominated. So you started, you did the CD, and you thought, okay, some people are going to be interested, and then you get the announcement that you're Grammy nominee. Tell us the story.
Right. Well, it was around Thanksgiving. It was just after Thanksgiving, and Brian Bromberg called Tom Zink, who is my husband. It's actually Tom. He was nominated for the arrangement. So I was the artist, and he is the arranger. And so Brian Bromberg called him and just left this message, Grammy nomination, best arrangement for singer, Tom Zink, Ann Walsh, artist. And we were stunned. And it was so cool to go to the Grammys and see your name up there with Klaus Elderman for Diana Krall, David Foster for Seal, and Tom Zink and Walsh. And to have your name up there with those people. Klaus Elderman won, but you know what? He's in his 80s, so we still got time.
Oh, you're going to get a Grammy someday. I can tell, especially your story. Your story's definitely at that. So when you attended the event, you must have been so blown away saying, wow, for somebody who didn't start singing to a certain time in my career, to be able to make it to this stage must be awesome. It's just huge.
Wow. You know, it's so nice to hear you say that because lately, you think, gosh, it's It's a wonderful business, and it's a tough business, and it's a never-ending work. And the way the internet is now, and viral marketing, and all that, there's so much out there, and there's so much that the artist has to do on their own. So it's a great thing, and it's a blessing. But you have been a blessing in my life to say that to me today, because we're working really hard, and sometimes, you know, it's nice for someone to say that, because you just think, wow, I'm tired.
I feel for you, Ann, and I, like I said, I just am suffering from bronchitis right now, and I've took my first antibiotic, and I feel like the world has changed in very quick format. That's very strange how antibiotics work, but I feel much better now. But yeah, I felt tired last night, so I feel for you.
Great. I'm so glad it's working.
It's not good if you're a radio guy to have a bronchitis. That's definitely not.
No.
So, okay.
No,
so,
it's working because I couldn't hear it.
No one hardly did, and it's because I would keep using my inhaler that I had for suffering from asthma already and just taking it as a mask and say, I don't want to go to the doctors. No, I'm going to wait on this. Oh, this cough will go away. It didn't. But going back to you, so once you had that Grammy nominee, it's like anything else. I have a lot of actors and producers, and they're part of an independent film that gets nominated. Then they get so much more opportunities for auditions and work. And that's what happened to you, it sounds like.
Right. And now we're just embarking on our next project. And, well, in 2011, we released another wonderful CD called Go. And actually, that was such a great CD, but the timing wasn't right, and we didn't really have the right PR person. And Rick Scott was our PR person for the Pretty World CD, and he is unbelievable. I hope he's listening now, because he knows. I saw him recently at somebody's CD release, and he was just so positive. And I said, you know, we're hiring you next time. It's just such a great time. Such a great, great guy. But anyway, so we are just in the beginning stages of arrangements for the next project. And the reason I bring it up is because it's like, you know, the old saying, publish or perish.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I know this in books. Absolutely. It's the same thing in books. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's exciting. And, you know, when you're ready, you know, you put things out there, you go out there, you work, you do concerts, you plan your tours, and then it's we're ready now. It's like we've been tossing around ideas, and we have two projects in mind, so we know the one we're beginning with. And you know, I can't even tell you very much about it because it has, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it has to be a surprise. Yeah.
So you have to keep that. So basically, where do you see yourself in your career? Where do you want to be? Let's just go with a very simple goal, which we have always on the Beach Lifestyle Show. Where do you see yourself in the next 90 days for your business, for your career? Where do you want to see yourself in the next 90 days?
The next 90 days.
Yeah.
I want my arrangements done for the next album. I want to be having the people in the studio recording. I'd like to see the album, you know, really well on its way in the next 90 days.
Well, fantastic. And where do you see yourself? Do you see yourself someday getting a Grammy? Do you feel that that's going to happen, that you were close last time, and now that specifically with so many years left in your career that it'll happen, especially when you saw who had defeated you in the Grammys, that you say, hey, you know what, if I keep plugging away, I'm going to finally get that Grammy?
Yes, well, I would hope so, and let's just say I know my work will be Grammy worthy.
All right.
And so it's kind of a popularity contest too. You know, you have to. So that's another thing. You know, you've got a network,
yes,
and you've got to have a team behind you. It's there's so much to it, as you can imagine.
Well, I understand completely just seeing artists and how they make it and where they go. And I see from my radio show how I'm able to network to help my business out through these relationships, like interviewing yourself and seeing opportunities where the door will open for myself. And that's what you have done so far in your career. So, Ann, where can we find more information on you, learn more about you, and purchase your latest CD?
AnnWalsh.com. My website, AnnEWALSH.com. And you can purchase my CD through CD Baby and iTunes.
Fantastic. And so, again, keep up the great work. It was very nice talking to you. And I told you it would be a painless interview, fun to learn about things, and really looking at your career and saying to yourself, hey, I made it. Now I have to continue to push forward to make it to where my ultimate goal and dream is, to win that Grammy and be considered one of the best singers. So thanks again for calling, Ann.
Well, thank you so much. And let's do this again.
Oh, we're going to definitely.
You are a positive light, and you made my day.
Well, thank you so much, and I enjoyed talking to you as well. And
you
just
too.
And hope for me that I feel better for my bronchitis, but take care.
Okay, take care. Right. Thanks.
See you, Ann.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye. You're listening to Total Education Celebrity Show, powered by the Beach Lifestyle segment, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education Spotlight Show, and I'm really excited to welcome another great Bronx teacher, not the Bronx teacher that we all know and love, but somebody that's doing such tremendous things in the community. I want to welcome the program, teacher Stephen Ritz, Green Bronx Machine. Stephen, thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for having me. Thrilled to be here, and thanks for recognizing the work that we are doing here in the South Bronx.
Well, fantastic, and I'm really excited to talk about it. And, I mean, I just am amazed how what you're doing, how you're really transforming people's lives, healthy lives, and teaching the kids as well. So tell us, I guess, your background, your story, and how this came about.
Well, it all came about by mistake, but I'm just relentlessly dedicated to student performance and student engagement. So I'm not a farmer, but I wound up inheriting a group of kids and a box of bulbs that gave birth on the back of a radiator after they got forced, and lo and behold, 25,000 bulbs planted that year later, I realized that kids really enjoyed growing things. That program gave birth to some of Majora Carter's work with Sustainable South Bronx and the BEST program. We gave birth to a Green Team program. We were able to move kids who were overage and undercredited to graduation within 2 years simply because they really appreciated having something to do. And that something to do was really taking abandoned spaces and forlorn places and turning them into highly productive places. So it was rather remarkable. And then with the advent of green roof and green wall technology, well, 30,000 pounds of vegetables later, I like to say my favorite crop is organically grown citizens, graduates, members of the middle class. In fact, I got a college graduation to go to next month, so I'm so excited I can't stand it. But closer to home, we've lost hundreds of pounds. I myself just lost 100 pounds. So we are doing things that are putting the big sales to shame in ways that make dollars and a whole lot of sense while generating jobs for kids and locally grown food, which everybody needs. It's win-win-win.
Well, it seems like a win-win-win, and the way it developed, I guess, was specifically, you said your background was a different type of background. You're not a farmer, but when you started doing this, I think you saw that there was a need in the community, that you can't find fresh vegetables, especially in the Bronx. You're not able to have the opportunity for kids to have healthy meals in the Bronx, that the background that they grow up in and different things like this, that this is just an absolute need, right?
Well, it's rather remarkable because the proliferation of fast food and sugar-sweetened beverages and single-serving portions in this community is insane. Yet 37%, according to Google, of all the residents in the Bronx are food challenged. So what are they buying? They're buying milk. They're buying cereal. They're buying bread. They're not having access to healthy, highly dense, nutritious food. When I started looking at sixth graders who were 200 pounds, I started realizing, and I myself was close to 300 pounds, because fast food is so damn expensive in terms of health costs, that I realized something had to change. So when you could grow food and grow delicious food and eat it and sell it and grow it year-round, particularly exponentially in classrooms, that to me was a game changer, and it was game on. But also linking it to living wage jobs was critical, and we were able to do that in ways that make dollars and cents and really drive kids' greening of America Sheriff is right through the pockets, Fifth National, to their hearts and to their minds.
Would you say that you you're definitely an entrepreneur in many ways, the way you're able to change people's lives in so many ways and make them entrepreneurial in spirit and as well?
I believe everybody is an entrepreneur. So I view my classroom and everything I do in terms of profit and loss, what's profitable and what's a liability. So when I can engage kids in health and wellness across the curriculum in ways that generate healthier outcomes for all and help mitigate some of the largest environmental challenges we face here in the South Bronx, whether it be, you know, stormwater overflow or you know, bad buildings or, you know, a lack of green, nurturing, community-based places, and can do that all by engaging kids in school, that to me is a highly profitable paradigm. But more importantly, when you can grow food efficaciously indoors all year round and get parents involved by giving it away and get parents to come to school and grandparents to come to school and really change eating habits and eating outcomes, that to me, it's just God's work. So I am the luckiest man on the planet.
Would you say?
So yes, I am an entrepreneur. I absolutely see it as entrepreneurial.
But to have your administration back you on this, to be able, because a lot of places don't allow you a lot of schools don't allow the teacher to be creative, to be able to do certain things like this. So you must be very blessed as well to have great administration and organization to help you build this Green Bronx machine.
Listen, I work and live in the greatest city in the world, and our Bronx Borough President, Ruben Diaz Jr., has been wonderfully supportive. I think Mayor Bloomberg has his eyes on a health paradigm for New York City, and while I may not always agree with some of the legislation, I certainly believe that talking about healthy food and calling attention to some of the chronic problems that we see in society, not only in schools but across society, is critical. So we're generating an awareness, and out of awareness comes action, and action is critical. Most importantly, though, I've been embraced recently by the U.S. Green Building Council and the Center for Green Schools, and I'm part of the Green Apple campaign. I'm thrilled to announce that I'm a national ambassador for the U.S. Green Building Council and a Green Apple and Education Ambassador, because we're dedicated to changing where kids learn. And, you know, every kid deserves a healthy, clean, safe, nurturing environment. And whether it's one plant in the classroom or a small garden or some systemic changes or building-wide changes that are going to drive performance and retention, we're committed to changing things in our lifetime. And to me, that's exciting.
Because, again, classrooms are not always the cleanest or healthiest places to be in. So,
right. A lot of my kids come to me with asthma, with a whole lot of challenges. But when you can take a classroom and turn it into a wholly aspirational and inspirational place, that's place-based learning that drives attendance. It also drives retention for teachers. Teachers want to work in beautiful, inspiring places. And simply sometimes an indoor garden, a beautiful green wall, or a place to congregate that's healthy and productive and aspirational is a game changer for an entire school and an entire community. It's really rather simple.
So what are your teachers, partners think of your classroom compared to theirs? They're pretty much...
Well, if you come to my classroom, I don't know if you've ever seen our Green Bronx Machine Facebook page or some of our TED Talk, but my classroom is a very different place. It is literally wall-to-wall growing. Something is always growing, whether they're seeds, vegetables, ornamental plants. Every kid has a role, every kid has a job, and every kid wants to be there. And to me, that's just remarkable. At the end of the day, I don't expect every kid to be a farmer, but I do expect them to read about it, write about it, blog about it, offer outstanding customer service, do the science, do the math, and do everything that's related to that. And to really be engaged and involved in the 21st century in ways that people have never imagined.
I'm impressed. And your publicity agent told me I would be so impressed by you. And you must spend hours upon hours. Your dedication must be tremendous as a teacher for what you've been able to do.
Well, listen, first and foremost, I'm a resident and I'm a parent, so I take these kids' lives seriously, and I treat these kids the way I treat my own kid, because I am local parentis, so I hold them accountable, but I also ask them to hold me accountable. But in a lot of ways, I believe kids are dying to be engaged. They're really ready to be engaged. So I jokingly say I'm the conductor of an orchestra I can't play an instrument of. I get a lot of credit for things I don't do but get other people to do, and that's half of it, being a good teacher, just, you know, managing people, managing relationships, and really managing outcomes.
And that's very important, because you're right. You have to be a teacher that moves mountains, that they are inspired by, that they understand how much you care for them. I did the same thing when I was a teacher, and I would say that you guys are my kids, just like my regular children at home. I treat you the same. I see that I'm not going to, you know, say that, you know, you're not my children. And I think that's what teachers need. We need more dedicated teachers that truly see the passion of helping children.
Well, I believe it's there. I believe everybody is a champion teacher. We just need to light that fire and let them embrace the inner champion within. I mean, these are very challenging times, but I think that kids respond to passion. And if you bring passion and you bring your A game, you're going to get results. And when you start getting your results, you start tweaking those results. You start looking at data. You start looking for patterns and trends and just moving it forward. And that's really, you know, the beauty of data-driven instruction in this modern age, that you can really do remarkable things. And that, to me, is just why I get up in the morning. I mean, quite frankly, if I had to eat this telephone that I'm speaking on to drive student engagement, I would. But I'm smart enough to realize that they probably just YouTube it, you know, watch it once and then look for something new. So you want to give something to kids that they can wrap their hands into, that's inclusive, that's diverse, that has a lot of layers to it. And most importantly, if they can eat it or turn around and grow it and sell it or give it to grandma and bring it home and use it on a daily basis, you know, my work is close to done. It's just managing the orchestra, if you will. And I'm thrilled to be in that position. I'm blessed.
Well,
but I never knew it would come through farming. Let me tell you, I grew up in the South Bronx, so to think that I'm farming is rather remarkable. The world would have been all better to me if it was like a nightclub, as far as I'm concerned. So the fact that I can do it and do it year-round with 21st-century technology indoors and have kids in wheelchairs, have veterans, have kids who can't be outside for various reasons, and kids who don't have access to clean spaces, do it indoors and participate in these kinds of things is just phenomenal.
It seems like it. And are people trying to copy you, which is a good thing, in other areas like the Bronx all over the country? Have you seen that? Are the people emailing you saying, how can I do this?
After my TED Talks, Stephen Ritz, the teacher going green in the South Bronx, I hear from people all over the country, which is rather remarkable. And to me, to think that, you know, the borough that gave birth to baggy pants and funky fresh beets is now home to organically grown red ones is really rather inspirational. It's really aspirational. And, of course, I have a borough of immigrants here. So I have kids who come to me from places because their parents immigrated here because they were hungry. So these kids want to send this technology home to Haiti, to Africa, to places where it's food challenged. And that, to me, is a kind of global awareness and global impact that we're having right here in the South Bronx. And that, to me, is rather remarkable.
And as I know, you're getting a lot of press. Tell us specifically, because we are almost running out of time, about specifically some of the shows you've been on, some of the articles that they've written about you and all this stuff, which is, I'm sure, also an amazing thing for you.
It's amazing because I'm hearing from people I haven't heard from in years. But, of course, there's our TED Talk. So please go to www.ted.com. Check out our TED Talk. Also, please go to the Green Bronx Machine Facebook page. Remarkably, the kids run it. I don't. And that's yet another way to get kids involved, doing something productive. You know, I'm thrilled that my kids are running a Facebook page that's dedicated to healthy initiatives instead of some of the other things that are going on Facebook. And on the Facebook page, you'll see links to ABC, NBC, CNN. Just last week, we were on the Today Show. I was featured on the ABC link. But for me, it's really about growing awareness. So please, like my kids on Facebook, send my TED Talk, reach out to us. The kids will write you back on my behalf. And that's half of it, getting kids involved to do the work that needs to be done so they can become 21st century citizens, engaged members of society, and productive.
Where do you see this going? What is your ultimate goal?
Well, I'm thrilled, like I said, to be working with the U.S. Green Building Council. So we certainly see replication, model, you know, replicating this model across the country and then possibly globally. Realize where in the United States, you know, there's a lot of litigation and a lot of food safety issues and food safety concerns that really we don't have in third world countries. So the ability to grow food cheaply and productively in third world countries where it's critically needed is really inspiring to me. But it's simple. Classroom by classroom, we're out to change this, the way kids come to school, go to school, eat, think about food, and, you know, and the way they perform in school. Because, again, I don't expect them to be farmers, but I expect them to read about it, write about it, blog about it, do the math. You need 10 outstanding vocabulary words to describe the wonderful fresh fruit that you're eating. You know, these are the kind of things that are really going to move kids forward. And it's real easy to align to Common Core, which I'm thrilled about. And, of course, the new green job industry, whether it's retrofitting, green roofs, green walls, destination learning, all these things are critical and really right at the forefront of what we're doing right here in the South Bronx. And that, to me, is remarkable. This green graffiti is transforming mindsets, waistlines, and communities. And that, to me, is rather remarkable.
Okay, so, Stephen, where can we find more information on you, learn more about you, and how our listeners could get involved and help out as well with the Green Bronx Machine?
Well, please go to our Facebook page. You can send notifications. Like the Green Bronx Machine Facebook page. Please, we're trying to, kids want to get to 10,000 likes, so I'm imploring everyone who's out there to please like them. You can follow us on Twitter. You can write to me. The kids get me all the information.